This week on Writers, Inc.
After 15 years of reading thousands of texts, I had come to understand how story actually works. And not to give away the ending, but basically it boils down to there are two components that you're working with in your memoir.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
It's Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. And welcome to 2025.
Yeah, first show of the year, man. We're already winning. We're already winning 2025, except for Jenna, who decided she was going to be sick.
I'm also sick, but I am here. But she has stomach sick, and I just have cough. You can have cough on.
I don't begrudge anybody taking that time. That's fine.
Nobody's allowed to be sick.
Yeah.
We don't have time for that.
You guys have avoided the inevitable visit your relatives and get the post-holiday sickness.
I've been lucky. I mean, with my daughter being in school, like we were talking about this before we started recording, like, you know, you're exposed to all kinds of crazy things at a school. And like the first couple of years we were sick, like every couple of weeks, it felt like we just finally, you know, got over something. Then we got in another bug. Yeah. A couple of times, I think we had two at the same time. Somebody told me once, you know, like we moved to New Hampshire from, you know, like we were in Pittsburgh and Florida before that. Like somebody had told me once that you get, you know, accustomed to like the local viruses. So when you move someplace new, all of a sudden you can get all these new bugs. So there might've been some of that, but like this year, none of us have gotten sick. We've been crazy lucky. And I probably shouldn't say that out loud because she'll probably bring someone home today.
But that's why I'm sick. Cause I went to Florida. I'm not used to Florida bugs.
Yeah. Oh, Florida's a cesspool. Yeah. You were at Disney, right?
Yeah. We were at Disney. That's definitely why I'm sick. Yeah.
It's a Petri dish.
It sure is.
Everybody got sick around here except for me.
Oh, so. Yeah. Yay for your immune system.
That's awesome. Strong like bull. Yeah.
So what is your favorite read of 2025? Do you actually have one?
I got two. I picked a nonfiction and fiction, but I'm willing to go last if you guys want to talk about yours first.
Well, see, now I'm at a disadvantage because I was trying to think of books that I read that were actually published in 2024 because most of the books
we weren't specific.
Not 2024 books. So my favorite book that was actually published in 2024 was The Spell Shop by Sarah Beth Durst. It was a debut. A friend recommended it to me. It was a wonderful like vacation read about a grumpy librarian whose library is burned down by revolutionaries. And she saves a bunch of books, most of them are spell books, and goes to this island where she tries to lay low and be grumpy, but the islanders won't let her, including a handsome merhorse farmer. So that was like my cozy hot chocolate read of the year.
Wait a minute.
It was
what
so
farmer?
Cute. Merhorse, you know, like mermaid horses. Okay. It's fantasy. You know, you got to throw in something.
What was Piers Anthony? It sounds like one of his books. All those like Xanth novels. Remember those?
Oh, yeah. It was so cute. It was probably like the only non-thriller I read this year. So maybe that's why it stood out. But also really liked Riley Sager's House Across the Lake, but that was a 2022 book.
That's fine.
I read that because he was on here and I read the only one left for the podcast and that book was amazing. So highly recommend.
Yeah, Riley's always good. What about you, Kevin?
I picked a nonfiction and fiction, but the fiction I did kind of cheat because it was Daniel Silva's A Death in Cornwall, I read because I was interviewing him, but I'm a big fan anyway. And I really enjoyed that book, and it's part of his sort of ongoing series with his characters, Gabriel and the rest. And it, you know, really good, really well done. I loved discovering that he too is a pantser, so that made the book even more exciting for me. it can be done. But the other book I picked from nonfiction was Slow Productivity, and this one came in under the wire because I read it right at the end of the year, but. It's surprisingly inspirational for writers. Like I don't know that he intended it that way. In fact, I know he didn't. He is aiming at kind of the knowledge worker set and how to keep from getting burnt out and overwhelmed and still be productive. But all of his best examples came from writers and authors. And it actually ended up being a kind of an inspirational book if you are a writer. So I recommend it. It's
Cool.
fun.
I'm crazy predictable, so I even brought props. So my favorite book of
Look
the
at
year
you.
was You Like It Darker by Stephen King. I get so many ARCs sent to me, and I try to read as many of them as I possibly can. And then every once in a while, I get a book that I really, really want to read. And there's only a handful of authors, kind of bring that out. But this was one of them. He wrote a sequel to Cujo. Now, if you've ever read the book for Cujo, or if you've seen the movie, like, it doesn't end well. It doesn't really, leave a whole lot on the table as far as sequels go. So, like, I was willing to pick this up just to see how he would pull that off. And he does, So it's just that to me, it was one of the best stories in the book. The fact that he kind of went back to horror a little bit, which, he's been really, doing quite a bit in the thriller world. Just it really reminded me of the stuff that I really, that I grew up reading, that I fell in love with as a kid. And I hope he does more of it.
See, what I think he should have done was combine Cujo and Pet Sematary, and then that's a hell of a like he, you know that's a that's
Crossover.
a that's callbacks across the board. You got two sequels for the price of one, so a little disappointed you didn't go that route, Stephen.
I can see all the attorneys raising their hand complaining about who owns what IP.
That's the problem with guys like that, with the careers like that. You know, the authors of his caliber tend to have their rights spread out like really thin peanut butter. I'm just
I've
saying.
run into it, because like he let me use some of his characters from Needful Things and Forsaken, and like every
Yeah.
one of my books has been optioned at least once or twice at this point, with the exception of that one. And like it always comes up, and like they like the story, they want to make it, and then they hear about the Stephen King tie-in, and then the lawyers raise their hand and they're like, well, but that's option, that's tied to Needful Things. Needful Things is optioned by so and so. We'd have to get permission, and everybody just backs away slowly, and like that happened at least three or four times now. So I've got a feeling like that's never going to get made just because of that.
Mean, could you get it? Could you do it without those references
That's the
or?
thing. Like you could easily strip it out, but
Yeah.
like they don't seem to want to go that route. They want to keep it in there.
Yeah.
Because
Yeah. Yeah.
it's almost like it's almost done in a way where it's like an Easter egg. Like it's easy enough to just completely yank it out of there. But yeah, for whatever reason, they don't want to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, what a pain. All right, we should probably get to the news. First news of the year. Streaming wars are over and Netflix won. Rivals like Disney are licensing content back to Netflix as competitors focus on reducing losses. That's right, you don't need Disney Plus to see Disney anymore. Aggressive cost-cutting measures coupled with the Hollywood writers' strike helped Netflix achieve record-high operating margins. Despite its dominance, streaming remains a low-revenue per-subscriber business. YouTube is more popular than any streaming service, and its user-generated content and ad-driven model is more profitable. I am really glad to see this because I am boycotting Disney Plus. We canceled our subscription, and there's some shows on there that I actually do kind of want to see. There's one show on there I want to see, but the rest is like it's just warmed over garbage all the time, and I'm just not going to pay them for the right to
Yeah.
do that.
I've
Yeah.
had Disney Plus for a long time because I have a son, and probably longer than I need it. And as soon as I saw this, I was like, oh yeah. And I canceled my Disney Plus immediately.
So is everything going over though? Is the whole
I don't know,
catalog?
but I mean, I don't really watch it other than I watched The Bear, which was awesome, but you probably can get that other places. But yeah, like obviously the numbers weren't adding up for Disney. Like it's a pretty low revenue per subscriber, as they said. It's not worth
Yeah.
their time. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Have you
Yeah.
guys cut cable? Like, are you strictly streaming
Oh
now?
yeah.
Yeah,
Oh
I
yeah.
have no
Me
cable.
too,
Years ago.
years ago, yeah.
I've got a reminder set up once a month where I review our subscriptions because it gets completely out of hand. And like with our
Yeah.
daughter, like she will, like the TV basically suggests stuff to her, and she's already figured out the little codes to just kind of add whatever channel she wants. So I ended up with like all these different ones. Yesterday, I was watching, what's it called, Landman. with Billy Bob Thornton, which is really good if you haven't had a chance to watch it yet. But I was on like a, I think a lower tier version of Paramount Plus that had like commercials in it. And it like the commercials kept freezing. Like it would like start the commercial break, but it would just show a slide, like an image. Like it was just very, very clunky. So like I upgraded to a different version of it, but now I've got two subscriptions to Paramount Plus that I'm paying for. You know, so like this is both good and bad. I mean, Netflix, like honestly, like works better than every other, you know, like you don't get any of those clunky issues. It never forgets where you are in a show. Like I've never had a problem with Netflix, but all these other ones seem to have these little bugs and weird intricacies to them. You're gonna see, unfortunately, with something like this, that means that they're licensing either in bulk or by show, or you know, they're grouping stuff together and packaging it. But stuff is just gonna come and go, you know. So you might start watching a Disney show on Netflix and then find out that it's leaving in 2 weeks and you've got to finish it or whatever. So like that kind of thing could happen.
I kind of predicted some of this early on, though, as all the plus apps started to kind of emerge, like because everyone wanted to own that, they wanted to own the revenue from that. But you know, piecemeal, it's not cost effective for anybody. So you know, somebody's going to lose in that fight, right? So like, if I'm paying for the one you just described, Paramount, if I'm paying for that, which I am, you know, that means there's one other app I'm probably not going to pay for because I don't want to spend more than I would on cable, you know, or whatever.
But
So,
yeah,
yeah.
but Paramount licensed to Amazon Prime too. So if there's something I really want to watch on Paramount, I'll pay the $5 for it, you know? I don't know.
That's the other way this is working. I think we're kind of starting to see things shake out. It's going to be interesting to see where it goes. But yeah, I think that apps like Disney Plus should die, frankly. I don't think there's any need for it, and I think that it gets a little predatory, especially after that whole thing where they tried to use their terms of service to keep that guy from suing because he was at the Disney, a restaurant at the Disney Springs or whatever. It's like, if we're going to start doing things like that, I just want to see them all go. All
So
right.
JD mentioned the odd pauses. So Kevin, can you answer this for me? Because why do
Yes.
Substacks, when you're listening to a podcast, not pick up where you are listening to them? Can you yell at them for me?
Oh,
Because it
I
drives
will
me
yell at them.
insane.
Okay,
I come
well,
back and I don't know where I am in that podcast.
I've been communicating with them recently, so we'll see. I hadn't noticed that, but I'll have to
Maybe
check it
there's
because
a way around it and everyone's yelling right now and I just don't know
maybe.
what it is, but I'm like literally screenshotting where I'm at in the podcast so I can
Yeah,
find
that's a
it again when I
pain.
go
Yeah,
back.
that's a big pain. Yeah, I host my show on Substack, but I listen to everything on the Apple Podcast app. So, yeah, I haven't noticed that. I will ask them as your duly appointed representative.
Thank you.
Next up, how co-writing a book threatened the Carters' marriage. No ex-president had a more prolific and diverse publishing career than Jimmy Carter. His more than two dozen books included nonfiction, poetry, fiction, religious meditations, and a children's story. His memoir, An Hour Before Daylight, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Everything to Gain, a 1987 collaboration with his wife, Rosalind, turned into the worst, quote, worst threat we ever experienced in our marriage. Their memories differed on various events, and they fell into, quote, constant arguments. They were ready to abandon the book and return the advance until their editor persuaded them to simply divide any disputed passages between them. In the book, each of the paragraphs is identified by a J or an R, and our marriage survived, he wrote. That's a
This one
nice
just made me laugh.
that's pretty funny. And they were right on the heels, of course, of President Carter's passing, but I can't imagine writing anything in tandem with my wife. That would lead to either divorce or, worst case, murder. And I would probably be the one.
My wife and I went back and forth just on an email yesterday that she had to send. She opened up a bank account and she was supposed to be getting a particular interest rate because of the amount that she put in there. And she got her statement and it was at like 0.001% rather than 5% interest. So like it was a big difference over 2 months. And you know, I used to work in the finance world, so I know how this works. I know what words to throw into an email that's going to spur the manager to get off their butt and fix it. But you know, you have to get a little harsh when you send something like that. And my wife is the exact opposite of harsh when it comes to writing it. So I drafted what I felt needed to be in there, sent it over to her, and told her which words she shouldn't change specifically because I knew what, you know, the outcome of using those particular words would be. And she said she stared at it and rewrote it like 20 times, you know, like a couple hours, just going back to it and coming back. And yeah, like, but it eventually went out and it got the job done. But like, you know, it took that, you know, just to get through an email. So I can't imagine writing a book. Carter, I mean, just to give him a shout out, I mean, like, this guy has been, I mean, 100 years old, so he's obviously been around for a very long time. But like, I remember in kindergarten, I voted for Carter for president. Like, that was,
Same.
we had the
Aww.
little
We did
cardboard
that
ballot
too.
box we had to do. So like, this is how far back he goes. You know, I'm 53 now. And back in, it was 1990 something, I did a Habitat for Humanity house that he was working on, and we were there for a week, you know, building this house with Jimmy Carter. And honestly, one of the nicest, coolest guys I have ever met. So yeah,
What a
I
guy.
may have to check out the book, even if him and his wife fought over it.
It just makes me want to read it even more.
I know. I was like, I love his
Kind
story. And I'm never writing with my spouse, so.
All right. Last story. Hundreds of bookstore staffers receive holiday bonuses from author James Patterson. 600 booksellers received $500 holiday bonuses from James Patterson, who has been awarding, rather, independent store employees since 2015. The winners were nominated by coworkers and customers, among others. It means everything to have him recognize and reward the valuable role booksellers play in the industry, Allison Hill, CEO of the American Booksellers Association, said in a statement. Along with his gifts to booksellers, Patterson has given millions of dollars to schools, libraries, and literacy programs. In 2015, the National Book Foundation presented him an honorary National Book Award, the Literarian Award, for outstanding service to the American literary community.
Yeah, this is one of those things, like, he does this year after year after year, and it just, you know, it makes me want to get out there and do more. The fact that I mean, he kept a lot of bookstores, you know, alive during COVID, you know, by doing things like this, and a lot of it's not talked about. So like, this is definitely something that should be talked about.
I remember, I think we actually had this same general story last year, as one of our like end of year or first of year stories, and I kind of checked into it. Like, it's really, he's got a partner in this, right? Like, he's got someone else who also contributes or does
No,
this.
his as far as I know, it's just him and his
And his
wife.
wife,
His
yeah.
wife kind of
Maybe
organizes
that's
it.
where it
We
was.
we've interviewed him a couple of times on Writers Inc, and in one of them he actually discusses it. I don't remember if it was the first one or second one.
That's a class act, man. I think the important thing is, like, in any way that you can give back, and this is something I want the authors listening who maybe, you know, you're not yet at a level where you can do things like, I'm going to give $500 to everyone who works for a bookstore. But, you know, anything you could do that encourages those people, like, that's goodwill. And it, you know, there's small things you could do. You know, these days it's kind of risky to try to bring along like brownies or something like that. You know, there's allergies, there's people doing funky terrorist-like things. But you know, just even just writing a nice post and tagging that bookstore, tagging specific people who work there or whatever, you know, something like that goes a long way towards elevating not only that person's, like, you know, sense of well-being and the accomplishment, but also, you know, encouraging the community to think about them, and it gives you a little bit of social credibility as well. So,
Love your booksellers.
love your booksellers and your libraries and your schools.
Absolutely.
Do all the things.
All right.
This week's episode is sponsored by Readzy. If you're planning to write a book in 2025, Readzy's 3-month novel writing course can help. We often set New Year's resolutions with the best of intentions, but without an actionable plan. When you join Readzy's How to Write a Novel course, you'll get the structure and accountability you need to actually finish your draft. Each week, you'll get videos that teach you about writing craft, live master classes with your instructor and guest authors, plus feedback and access to a supportive community of writers to help you stay on track. Dive into topics like character building, plot skills, dialogue, soggy middles, and other magic ingredients that make your character's narrative come alive. To find out more about the How to Write a Novel course, head to readzy.com/learning. Registrations are now open for the next cohort, start on March 3rd, but be quick as spaces are limited. Use coupon code WritersInc at checkout for 10% off the tuition fee. Check out this course now and you could take write a book off of your bucket list by spring.
Okay, JD, who is up this week?
This week we've got Wendy Dale coming on. Wendy is the author of The Memoir Engineering System, which teaches you to craft a memoir with a simple 7-step process built on 15 years of experience spent deconstructing thousands of manuscripts. If you're concerned a memoir, you won't want to miss this one. Wendy Dale.
Wendy Dale, welcome to Writers, Inc. What fun to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, James.
I can feel a lot of energy coming down the line. You feel like a very energetic person. Is that right?
Really? I suppose. I am a writer, so, you know, I have my days of solitude and my hermit days. But yes, once I get out, once they let me out and I get to talk to other people, I think I really enjoy it.
Yeah, we shouldn't let writers out too often, but occasionally, if we, in small doses, exactly, they're allowed to communicate with the rest of the world. Now, we were just talking off air, but I think it's interesting the fact you live in Peru now, which I think is a bit of a first for me. I'm not sure if I've interviewed anyone in Peru before.
I guess there's not a huge literary community in Cusco, Peru, but yes, I've been here for almost 5 years. I actually lived in Peru when I was a kid, and so it's not such a strange choice. My father is a mining engineer, and when I was 4 years old, we moved to the southern part of Peru for my father worked in a copper mine. So I actually kind of grew up in Peru. My first memories are of living in South America.
Wow. And what's it like? I mean, you've lived in the States before, you are originally from the US. What's it like? How does it feel different living in Peru? This has got nothing to do with your book or question. I'm just interested.
I don't mind. How does it feel different? I don't know. It's kind of saying, how do oranges taste different than apples? Let's see. How is Peru different? I would say it's a lot slower. I don't want to speak badly of the United States, but I think it's a lot more humane. I think it's kinder. I think one of my favorite parts of living in Cusco is a sense of community. I know all of my neighbors. I had my neighbor's mother died, and it was just so touching how everyone from blocks around came to the funeral. So I find that I didn't have that. I mean, I spent most of my time in the States in Los Angeles. So I think, you know, your whole block, your mother's funeral is not likely to happen. But this is a city of 400,000 people, and it really has maintained that sense of community.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true generally of the big cities and the big, you know, the more civilized, in inverted commas, a country is, kind of the less humane and soulful it probably is. We often say that about cities, that they're big, but they have no soul type thing.
And this is a city of 400,000 people, but it hasn't lost, I mean, it's a relatively big city. It hasn't lost that. I think it really is, it is part of Peruvian culture. And just their descendants from the Incas. And I think that this, you know, goes back hundreds and even thousands of years, this sense of hospitality and caring about your neighbor.
Okay, well, look, let's talk about memoir, which is sort of kind of where we are. We talked a bit about you and your background, which is kind of what memoir is. You've written a book about writing memoirs. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But you're known for a memoir about a vacation. Now, I have to say straight away, I've looked at your new book. I haven't read your older book, but it looks like a vacation that went wrong. Is that right?
So it's called Avoiding Prison and Other Noble Vacation Goals. And I tell people, well, I wasn't successful. Spoiler alert, I wasn't successful at avoiding prison. Now, I did only go as a visitor, but yes, it was the book. It's about what I lived through my 20s, about going to a bunch of foreign countries and doing what a lot of 20-year-olds do, or what I did back then, which was get into trouble and do the things that I would later not do in my 30s and 40s. So,
and that was your memoir, which I guess was your first foray into memoir writing and got you thinking about the way and structure and approach to writing memoir?
Yes. Now, once upon a time, when I decided I wanted to be a writer, I thought that writing memoir would be easy because you don't need plot, right? You just write about your life. And so the first draft, well, it really wasn't even the first draft. It was probably the 12th draft of the book when I finally thought it was done. I sent it to multiple agents, and one of them got back to me and she said, you know, you have a really great narrative voice. You know nothing about structure. And I still remember the thoughts that went through my head. And I went, what is this structure thing she's talking about? Because I had never heard the word. So it was this learning curve for me that memoir is really not a bunch of, even as interesting as your stories might be, If you don't turn those interesting stories into plot, your memoir isn't going to work.
Yeah. And this is one of the things people don't realize about nonfiction generally, I think. I read a lot of nonfiction, and bad nonfiction is basically quite academic and a set of things that happened. Good nonfiction, and I have a couple of my favorite authors, it's like reading a novel. It's, as you say, it's plot and story.
Exactly. I couldn't say it better myself. Your memoir should feel like a novel, but it's a lot harder to get there because you can't make things up. So you have all of the events in your life to draw from, and you need to pick out the ones that are going to create plot in your book, which is a challenge.
So how do you approach that, and how have you set this out without, I mean, there's a whole book to go through here, but how do we start that process? Yeah.
So really, when I wrote my memoir, I did not know the principles of structure. This agent decided to sign me anyway. She took a chance with me. She really helped me. It took me a year to rewrite it. And even after I had finished that memoir, I still didn't understand structure. I had managed through trial and error to structure one book. So people go back to your book, to my book, and say, oh, well, I want to understand the structure in your book. Well, I'm like, I don't understand the structure in that book. That book was written by trial and error. It wasn't until years later that I actually became a memoir writing teacher that I became a little bit obsessed with the idea that there were principles that all books follow, all stories follow. So not hard nonfiction, but memoirs and novels, that there were principles that go into telling a story. And that if you understood these principles, you could write a book without having to rewrite and rewrite, because you would be creating plot in your first draft. So it took me a long time. It really took me 15 years of reading thousands of texts. And what really helped was that as a memoir writing teacher, these were imperfect texts. It's really hard to look at a memoir. Way back when I was trying to do my own memoir, I analyzed memoirs and I didn't get very far because they're so well constructed that you can't see what's happening, right? And it's like a bad movie. If you want to learn how to write screenplays, go watch a bad movie, right? Because you, that's what I would do differently. And you start to learn the principles. So after 15 years of reading thousands of texts, I had come to understand how story actually works. And not to give away the ending, but basically it boils down to there are two components that you're working with in your memoir. And you have scenes and transitions. And when you use them in the right way, you have structure.
So you start off, I can already start to see how this works. I guess you start off, do you start off by kind of writing out headlines of everything you want to include in the book and then start to see the scenes within them? And how many scenes would you look at as you'd need for a good memoir?
How many scenes, you're asking? Is it what you said?
Yeah. I mean, no.
I have never been asked that question before. I have never counted. I don't know. That really is a matter of style. I see some writers, you know, have tiny scenes with long transitions. I have some writers, long scenes. So I don't really know.
I suppose from
how long your scenes are.
Yeah, I come from a fiction writing background. So I would think if I write a thriller, it's short, should be short chapters. I'm not very good at that, but that is probably between 50 and 70 chapters, which are effectively scenes in a novel.
Okay.
I mean, maybe a longer literary fiction novel might be 35, something like that, because they have longer chapters. Mm-hmm. Is that starting to sound like, I mean, because there's got to be, like I was saying just now, there's got to be a relationship here between the basic structure of a story, whether it's a novel, whether it's a science textbook, or whether it's a memoir. It's got to be more or less the same, right?
Exactly. So let's go back a step and explain to you a problem that you don't have as a fiction writer that a memoir writer does have, right? And a memoir writer is confusing their memories of their life with a story. So for instance, let's take a detective story, right? Let's take something that sounds a little bit like fiction, and let's say that you are a detective and you're writing a memoir about being a detective. And so you go and you find this bloody handkerchief in this abandoned house, right? And so what is the next scene going to be? Make it up, James. What do you think the next scene would be?
I think visiting the widow to let her know and then becoming suspicious about the way she reacts.
Okay, there you go. Perfect. Right. So what a memoir writer will do, if that really happened, is a memoir writer will find the handkerchief And then they'll decide, oh, this is very interesting, but actually I'm a little bit hungry, so let me go buy a bagel. And so they'll have a scene about them buying a bagel, and then their mother will call them. So what is happening, are you seeing, is that we have all of these events and they aren't plot. It's a bunch of stuff that a writer remembers. A novelist doesn't have that problem because you have causality. So I do talk in the book about causality. That's how fiction writers create plot. One event brings about the next, right? And so you find the bloody handkerchief, so you go talk to the widow, right? You wouldn't be talking to the widow if you hadn't found a bloody handkerchief. So you only make up what is necessary to create plot. A memoir writer's biggest challenge is taking all of the things they remember and finding plot in there. So the way I have them get there is to understand the difference between scenes and transitions. So you start with your scenes. James, I know as a fiction writer, you're going to be like, how can you have a book without scenes? And the answer is you can't. But I see so many manuscripts that are devoid of scenes because that is another problem I see. Memoir writers are describing their life, right? And so by understanding the principles of structure, we solve all of these problems. So you start with what happens in your book. And what happens, so we start with outlining your book. Outlining is not fun for anyone, but it's really important for memoir writers. So we start with what happens, and those become your scenes. And then as a secondary step, we talk about how do you connect those scenes. And because how do you connect these, what happens with memoir writers is they remember a bunch of things, but these events aren't related in any way. It's just this happened to me, then this happened to me, then this happened to me. And it's very boring. There's no suspense. And so if you understand how transitions work, in your transition, you have a point that you're making that helps me understand what your first scene has to do with your second scene. So it's not a bunch of stuff you remember. So it's using scenes and transitions in the right way. I know I said a lot there. I think you probably have some follow-up questions. Where did I lose you? Yeah.
You didn't lose me. I think the immediate thing that's popped into my head is that I think this is a challenge, excuse me, for writers of memoir who probably aren't writers generally. They're somebody who has a life story they want to tell, which doesn't make them a writer. So they start off, and your job as a coach for them is to get them out of their own way in a way to just to find a very different way of telling the story from one they thought they were going to be doing, I imagine.
So I work with non-writers as well as professional writers. So I've worked with screenwriters, I've worked with television writers, I've worked with New York Times reporters, and I've also worked with psychologists and lawyers and doctors who haven't written. So I've written with both of them. And what excites me is that the principles work for everyone. Even the professional writers are struggling to take the memories of their life and turn them into plot. They have the exact same problems as newbie writers. They really do. And so the principles allow them to take these memories from their life and turn them into a story. So one thing I tell people is that there is a big difference between autobiography and memoir, right? Autobiography is a bunch of stuff that a famous person lived through. You're not writing an autobiography, you're writing a memoir. We need a story. There needs to be a search.
Do you find people resistant to that? Do they, because it's their story, right? Do they think they know best how to tell it and they don't need to do this formula?
It's very hard. Emotionally, it's very difficult to leave things out because the story you have in your head about your life, it has all of these events. And I come in and I'm like, take this one out, take this one out, take this one out, take this one out. And that is can be very difficult for people. But once they grasp it, then they see the value in it. But emotionally, it is a different challenge than being a novelist. Absolutely.
And do you work with people? Do you ever work with people where you think there's no point to this memoir? You haven't lived an interesting enough life in this case? Or do you think we all have a memoir in us if we want to do that?
Well, I think memoir is a lot closer to literary fiction, partly because no one's memoir is going to resemble a thriller. I've even read memoirs written by a former CIA agent. They still don't read like thrillers. They don't. And so I think all memoir is closer to literary fiction, which is based more on the prose than the plot itself. So I tell people, your structure's either working or it's not. We're not looking for the best possible plot, unlike in a thriller. In a thriller, you really are seeking the best possible plot. In memoir, that's not the case. You're looking for your plot to hold your story together, but what's going to affect your reader, what's going to make them love your book or not, really is the prose.
And people presumably have very different reasons for writing memoir. I guess some people want to pass on some sort of life experience. Others maybe want to use it as a calling card for their profession.
Yes, there are lots of reasons to do it. And people come to me for all different reasons, but I specialize in helping them write books that readers will pay money for. So people will say to me, I'm writing a legacy book and, you know, I want my grandkids to read it. And I'm like, good for you. Go write it. You don't need me, because your grandkids love grandma and they want to read grandma's book, what she lived through. It's a different challenge to have a stranger care about your life, right? It really, you know, imagine no one cares about a stranger's life, nor will you pay money to spend 300 pages reading about a stranger's life. So you have to create a story. Just like with a novel, why do we read fiction? This person doesn't even exist. It's a good story. It pulls us in. It affects us emotionally. And the same is true for mom.
And what in your view makes a good, compelling start? So you got a lot of people walk through your door, want coaching. What are there certain types of people or types of lives they've lived where you think straight away, yeah, that's going to work?
So going back to, I think I didn't fully answer your question. I really think it is the writing itself.
Okay.
So sometimes these really otherworldly stories don't even make the best memoirs, because we want to relate to the person. So if you are writing a thriller, we need to relate to the main character in some way. And that happens pretty organically with memoir. So you don't need this story that's out of this world, just like literary fiction.
Yeah. I mean, a few years ago, we had, what was it called? The sort of nickname for it about people who had addictions and stuff. Some sort of lit, wasn't it? Some lit or other. But I loved it. Actually, you know, I read one after another of people who'd went through alcoholism or went through drug addiction as a child and stuff. And it's eye-opening into somebody else's view. But I'm assuming, looking back, those books were not simply just, this is what happened to me. These were people who had taken on board this type of lesson you're talking about and told a story, because I read all these books from beginning to end.
Exactly. They weren't everything the writer lived through. So in order to write a good memoir, you need plot and prose. And especially with memoir, not so much with commercial fiction, but with memoir and literary fiction, the writing itself is really important. And I tell my writers there's a difference between subjective writing and objective writing. And objective writing is what you see. I tell my writers that your book is not a visual experience. You're creating an emotional experience. And the way to do that is with subjective writing. And that is really putting us inside the narrator's head. So you're really, that's also what you're referring to. First of all, these books were all about something. They were about overcoming an addiction. So there's a search there, but we're also inside the narrator's head in a way that you often aren't in commercial fiction. So there is this really personal relationship you have with the narrator of memoir.
And do you get involved in the content side of things at all with people? Do you sort of encourage them to be more open, to share more? Because that's probably going... In fact, I watched Cher, the singer, I can never say her name properly, on Jimmy Fallon the other night. She was talking about her autobiography she's just written. And she said she rejected her first draft. She read her first draft and she thought, no, I've got to give more. I've got to tell more about myself. So this is a no-holds-barred version. And I'm thinking cynically, because I work in publishing, that what happened is she went to her editor and her editor said to her, you're going to have to give us more than this for the advance we're giving you. So she went back and rewrote it and gave a little bit more juice in it. But do you get involved in that side of things, saying, no, you've got to open up here, you've got to give more? Or do you think you decide how much you want to give and we can make the story work?
I have the opposite problem. I think people who come to me really are open to sharing and they really want to get their life down on the page. And I tend to say, no, this doesn't go in, this doesn't go in, this doesn't go in, this doesn't go in. So yes, you don't have to put everything in a memoir, I think is your question. There are certain secrets that you can keep. This isn't a tell-all book, right? And so you don't have to go to your deepest, darkest secrets. You have to be open, but the people I work with, it's rarely a problem, to be honest with you.
They're oversharers.
There you go. They're oversharers.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I probably would be as well. I probably won't write a memoir just for that reason. So is there a good market for memoir?
Yes, there really is. I think that in the same way that people really like true stories, people love the fact that this is a true story. So it reads like a novel. I'm getting a great story that pulls me in and also has the benefit of being true. Not to mention the practical aspect. If you're writing a memoir, it's actually easier to publicize your book, because you can go on podcasts and talk about your life as opposed to a novelist. And it's like, well, you know, you can talk about what you wrote, but I think it's easier to publicize memoir.
Mm. And one of the, I have a list on my wall. I think it's from the Pixar guys from years ago about the kind of rules of story. And one of them is that we admire characters more for trying than for succeeding. And which is something to remind yourself when, yeah. So I'm thinking this is probably because the other thing people might want to do is, maybe we look at our own lives through rose-tinted glasses and we forget the struggle that happened at the time, or we're slightly embarrassed about the failures. But that, for me, you talked earlier about having an emotional effect on your readers. That, for me, is where the emotion would come from, is living the struggle with somebody.
Absolutely. I think people are afraid sometimes of looking imperfect. And I tell them, we don't like perfect people. We really don't. I had a client and she was so, many years ago, so perfect. I mean, she had a master's degree. She was married to a man who was not only a doctor, but also a lawyer. She had been a model. So she was beautiful and brilliant. And I just didn't relate to her. And then she started telling me about her problems with her mother. And I was like, finally, you're a human being. We really don't relate to perfect people. We see ourselves in problems. We see ourselves in bad decisions as well. That's when we like someone. Ironically, it really is kind of counterintuitive. But being imperfect on the page is one of the best things you can do for your reader.
Now, that's really interesting. And it's making me think of a couple of autobiographies I've read of astronauts. And without naming any names, two of them, one of them I gave up on halfway through because their opinion of themselves was so high and nothing was too much trouble for them or a challenge for them. And I thought at some point you must have found something hard, but that became nothing to read in the end. And the other guy, he was a huge name and I wanted to finish the book, but it was a little bit how great am I over that much of, you know, 2 inches of book. That's not a good plan, right?
No, it really isn't. Being yourself on the page is hard to do, but it is what pulls a reader in. We relate to you that way. We see ourselves in you.
So you're talking, I mean, this is, I suppose, being objective about the most subjective thing in the world, which is you. How do you even do that?
You need to be objective. I think you need to be subjective about the most subjective thing in the world. Even when I tell writers, even when it comes to describing your characters, I think there's this tendency to describe what someone looked like and to be objective. And I tell people, no, even when it comes to your characters, we want you to tell us how to feel about them. We really do.
I guess people are buying into it's a point of view, right? That's the whole point of a memoir.
It really is. It really is a point of view. And we need that point of view in order to root for you.
Yeah. So tell us about your work. You take all comers, do you, for coaching on memoir? And it sounded like you have quite a range of clients.
We do. We have a big range of clients. We usually have people start with a free memoir class and then they reach out to us. We have video courses for people who want to do it on their own. And we also have coaching programs.
And you should probably tell us, we'll talk about the book in a second, but tell us where people can find you, should they be interested in some of this.
The easiest way to find us is freememoirclass.com, which will actually direct you straight to the website. So even if you're not interested in a free class, you'll find other information on the website. That's the easiest place to find us.
The book, which we're hoping to time the interview perfectly for you in January 2025, The Memoir Engineering System, Make Your First Draft Your Final Draft, which is a bit of an anathema for fiction writers, I have to say, because we go with the Ernest Hemingway, everyone's first draft is shit comment.
Exactly. So I hear you, right? I'm not saying that you won't refine your prose, but I really do believe that you get that outline, you figure out the plot of your book beforehand, what kills me as a writer is, right, I love prose so much, right? And writing scene after scene that I just love and then having to throw it out because it doesn't advance the plot. So it really is in a memoir writer's best interest to figure out, to outline their book first. And that way they're not writing draft after draft.
So it's interesting to me, and the one big takeaway I've got from this interview is that there's so many similarities to the way that we write fiction books. You know, we're always told by editors, you test your scenes. Does it need to be there? Does it advance the plot? Do we learn anything? Otherwise, strike it. It goes out. That seems to me it's a lot of the same principles.
It really is the same principles, but it's much harder for memoir writers. So if you want to become an even better fiction writer, or for it to become easier for you, write a memoir and then go back to fiction.
I might write a fictitious memoir about me as an astronaut. Now I can go on about how great I was when I walked on the moon.
I love it. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think it'll work. Wendy, it's been really fun talking to you all the way from Peru. Your internet signal, by the way, is better than the ones when I talk to my neighbours, which is so typical of the UK's broadband situation, but there you are in Peru. So that's great. No, really good luck with the book. Look forward to seeing it on the shelves. And I suspect you're going to probably have some customers as a result of people listening to this.
Thank you so much, James.
So the thing that I thought was most interesting that she talked about was when you're writing a memoir, knowing what to include and what not to include. Yeah. Like she's like, cut this, cut this, cut this. So what would be the most interesting thing about your life you would include in your memoir? Because I know you both have memoirs in you. You have enough material there.
Oh, wow. I'm not ready to write that yet.
No.
To be honest with you, like back in college, you know, I've talked about, you know, I interviewed a bunch of celebrities and stuff that I wrote for newspapers and magazines. One of the other things I was doing at the time, you know, I worked very heavily in the music industry on promoting bands. I had a bunch of bands that I managed. I used to rent nightclubs and put on shows and split the door. But like it was a big revenue source for me. And one night I was coming home from a recording studio and I got in a really bad motorcycle accident that laid me up for about 2 years. I didn't walk for 2 years. And it literally changed my life because by the time I came out of that, you know, like that's one of those businesses where it's all about who you know. And like everything had changed by the time I was able to get back in it. So like, you know, one minute I'm coming home from recording studio 3 o'clock in the morning, thinking about what I'm going to do the next day. And the rug just got yanked out from under me. So that would definitely make the cut.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that story, by the way.
I knew you had a bad motorcycle accident. I didn't know you didn't walk for 2 years. I know you had like facial reconstruction and.
Oh yeah, no, it completely messed me up. My right leg is now a half inch shorter than my left leg, which causes all kinds of problems over time. So, my jaws had to be reconstructed. I had I was a mess. Yeah.
So I did not know that, and I wrote that whole scene in the book we're working on. About guy recovering from a motorcycle accident. So I hope that doesn't.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You open with that. Yeah. Anytime. It's funny because when I read stuff like that or I see it, you know, like I can't watch Evel Knievel, you know, like anything that. Like it just, like I feel that like in every bone. Like, you know, I still feel it to this day, like where I broke is I shattered my right leg. I broke it in like 6 different places.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. So I do not recommend that.
No, I can't imagine that. I broke my leg in one, just the small bone. What's it called? Fibula. And I can still feel it. It still gets pain occasionally based on, I can't imagine breaking your leg in 6 places. That said, you gave a lovely answer because yours was nice and focal. This is what my memoir would be about, right? I think it's easy to get like scattered when you have so many things happening in your life.
Yeah, that's my problem. I got two problems. One, I have this fear that my life isn't interesting enough for a memoir.
You've had like 20 jobs. Like
people keep telling me things like that. So I'm going to give it a shot. I've got some ideas, but I don't know what to focus on as like a theme because she's right. And Joanna Penn told me something very similar. Like, you know, it's not a biography. It's not an autobiography. It's not about that. It's about exploring a theme through the work. And like, I got a couple of cool things that I would love to include in a book like that. Like, you know, I've been in a plane crash in a vintage warplane, for example, which is an interesting story, but it's not, I don't know that I could build a whole theme around that. But the other one that I was thinking about was this whole story when I met my paternal grandfather for the first time, and I hadn't yet met my father. I had just met my sister, and Yeah, we had this whole thing where I came and met him in his home, and he was telling me, like, just a couple of days ago after I got the call from Tina that, you know, you were going to come and meet me, I was out in my shed, and, like, you know, 38 years ago, which was the age I was at that time, he says, I was out in the backyard, and I took off this puzzle ring, and I lost it. I just didn't know where it went, and I was in the shed. And I looked up on just a random crossbeam, and it was sitting there. It had been sitting there for 38 years. And I was thinking, oh my God, he's going to give me this ring. What powerful symbolism, you know? But he's like, isn't that cool? And he puts it back on his hand, you know? And then when he passed away a few months later, Tina reached out and said, I got something for you from him. He left you something. I'm like, oh, he's leaving me that ring. He got it. He got the symbolism. But no, she sent me this pocket knife that he used to carry back when he worked at Dow or something. Like, so nobody but me got that. No one caught the symbolism, the metaphor of the puzzle ring. So I thought that might make kind of an interesting theme, actually.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this and be like, man, if I had to write a memoir, what would it be about? And everything I thought about it, I was like, that might be interesting, but I don't want to write about that because it's painful. Or like, I'm like... So anyone who can write about that, you know, you both know I had a spouse die of cancer, like, for 3 years. And I'm like, I really don't want to write about that. That would be a horrible thing to write about. And then everything else is just like my work, and it would be boring. I don't know.
That's honestly what makes it that's what makes it the thing you have to write about.
I know,
that's
what, I don't want to write about that. That would be just like me crying over a keyboard.
Like, it's like, you know, psychiatrists would tell you that, you know, that's how you deal with that trauma. I don't agree with that necessarily, but you know,
future focus.
Don't write something that's going to traumatize you first.
Yeah, and like that would be traumatizing. I would need to go through therapy while writing that to get through it, I would think. Yeah.
At the same time, though, you could see where that would be a story that would be impactful and even helpful to other people. Yeah. So I get that as an internal battle, because there's you got to weigh that, like, okay, you don't. I remember going in and attending back in like high school. We went to this thing at the University of Texas. It was like a journalism camp, and there was a woman there talking about writing like personal essay style articles. And I'm sorry, I'm going to have to use some strong language here, but her advice was don't rape your past as content, meaning don't take your, you know, don't take whatever strong emotional thing that's happened to you and just, you know, prostitute it out, basically.
Yeah.
And that's stuck with me. Like, I was probably 16 years old when I heard that, and it stuck with me all this time. You know, if you learn to deal with that, if you kind of come to grips with it and you've learned from it.
I was just like, ugh. No thanks. I mean, for some people it would be cathartic. I just don't think that's my personality. And then I'm like, I think my work is interesting, but I'm like, I do that for work. I don't want to write about it. Writing is for fun, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah. And the other part I thought was interesting is where she's like, there are these things that aren't scenes or transition, just these coffee scenes that people want to keep in there and they can't let go of.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you feel like that would be something you would struggle with, like, there's, I need to put this in my memoir, but
see, no, I don't think I would struggle with taking things like that out, because that's the kind of thing that I have to pay attention
to. We do that in fiction, right?
Fiction,
and like, maybe
it's different, because I've written a bunch of memoirs for other people, you know, so typically the way that starts is I'll interview them. We get a bunch of stuff back then, it was on tape. In today's world, you've got things like Plaid where it'll transcribe it and, you know, put it all down on paper and stuff for you. But, you know, I would get them talking, try to get them talking about the things they don't want to talk about, you know, kind of like what you just mentioned, because that tends to be where the gold is. And then I would write it all up. And a lot of times there's always those stories, and like those stories that they want to tell you, the ones that they feel should be in the memoir, a lot of times they're not the stories that need to be in, that like nobody's going to care about those things, but it's important to them, you know? So like, I would still write that stuff up along with the other stuff that I knew needed to actually be in the book. I would show it all to them. I would show them where our word count was, tell them where the word count needed to be. And you kind of have to backpedal, you know, like well, we can take this out. I know you love this particular yeah. scene, but you know, it's this number of words and, you know, we need to get it down to this. And like, you can get them to do it. But for whatever reason, people tend, they want to hold on to those scenes that are important to them, but not necessarily to other people. And, you know, for better or worse, you know, like Kevin, the stuff that you just described, you know, like this woman said to not use is what yeah. everybody wants.
Right.
You know, like
right.
that's what causes them to pick up that book. So, you know, you have to take a step back, I think, and look at it for what it is, which is a product, you know, something you're going to sell in the end. And you have to act accordingly.
I think that's the key, though, mm-hmm. right? Like I guess her advice really is don't do that simply for the sake of like, that's what's going to be a hot market product. Do it because I've dealt with it now and I can see the value of it for someone else, right? So
right.
It's not, you know, it's really just down to, it's a little bit like right to market in its way. Like, you know, you don't want to just start grabbing things out of your past and using them like, you know, all they're good for is content. You yeah. want to actually do things that are meaningful for others and helpful and useful, but are coming from a place of, you know, health and strength within you.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to just start grab, because I got a lot of traumas in my past that would make great content, but I, you know, if I write about it, what am I gaining? You know, am right. I just, you know, so that's what I think it is. But then there's me. I am an open book. I talk too much about the things in my life, so I don't think there's anything that's off limits for
no.
me.
Yeah, I think you're right. She had said, like, you know, if you just want this to be for your kids to know about your life, or, you know, yeah. just for you to get out, that's one thing. But if you're writing a memoir, you have to be able to say this is a product.
I'll tell you this, though. The universe is definitely telling me to write a damn memoir.
All right.
Because every time I turn around, another guest or somebody is talking about this. So.
Okay. Is that your 2025 resolution, Kevin?
I'm going to have to. Yeah, I'm going to have to put that on the list of 2025 things. At least get started on something. Cause
yeah, I'll be your accountability buddy. I'll text and nag you once a month.
We've got a really good interview with Matthew McConaughey that we did a few years back when he wrote Green Lights. If anybody's actually thinking about writing a memoir, they should check that one out. Because he goes into this entire process, and he's one of those guys where he documented everything, like his mm-hmm. entire life. He kept diaries, journals. He lived in an Airstream forever. And as far as I know, that Airstream is still parked like in front of his house, you know, like in California or wherever he lives. Like, he spends more time in there, you know, than he does in the big house behind it. Mm-hmm. But he rigged a microphone, like, you know, above his head, above the steering wheel, so that he could record thoughts like as he was driving, you know, in his truck. You know, like, he recorded everything, but he went through the process of how he weeded through all that material, because he had so much. Got it to the point of Green Lights, which is probably my favorite memoir I've read to date.
I listened to that. I think so. That came out like during the pandemic era, right? Like, because I remember,
I think so. Yeah, it's like 2 or 3 years ago now.
Yeah, I listened to that while taking walks. Because I went into kind of like an existential crisis starting around that time. And I remember listening to that, because and he reads it. And so it was very, like, it was a great memoir. And it reminded me, he went through a lot of the same kind of stuff I went through. So it's kind of inspirational in its way. It's sort of like, yeah, okay, I can do this. It's a very encouraging memoir. So.
He did a great job of balancing those things that you don't want to talk about. He talked about them, but he balanced those with the positive stuff too, which is why I think the book shines so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got PC Cast coming on. She's got a wild life. She's a number one New York Times bestseller, former member of the U.S. Air Force, and she taught high school for 15 years. Her latest novel is called Boudicca. It's a sexy, action-packed historical romance novel releasing at the end of the month. PC Cast.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.